go?
Welcome.
Okay, let's get started. I want to thank everyone for coming. And this is a presentation that I saw a couple of weeks ago at Commonwealth North, and it was such a fascinating presentation. I thought, and there was a real interest in the group to have this broadcast statewide, and so we are. It is being broadcast on legislative TV, and I know there are a number of people who have signed in to watch it. And it's about a new tech. It's about a technology that it's another option that's out on the table for how we can use our stranded gas on the North Slope to significantly reduce Alaska's heating and electricity costs, predominantly in interior Alaska and in rural Alaska. And it's really a fascinating presentation. I know this idea of high voltage direct current lines has been around for a long time, but I think the technology has really exploded in recent years. So we'll hear more about it today. We've got a very impressive lineup of people to speak. And starting off is Mira Kohler, who's anyone who works with energy in Alaska knows Mira. She is legendary in the state. She's CEO and president of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. And we're also going to hear from March Creek Vice President of Science and Technology, Dr. Robert Jacobson. It's a fascinating presentation. We're hoping to get done by 1 o'clock. There's lunch here. If for those of you who haven't had it, we have some boxed lunches here. Feel free to come up and grab some. And just for the record, we have Senator Davis with us. We have Senator Dyson, myself, Wilikowski. I've gotten a few calls from other offices. I believe there are others online as well. And I'm going to turn it over to you, Mira. Welcome to the committee. If you could, not the committee, but to the informal gathering of legislators, if you could just tell us who you are and jump right into your presentation.
Thank you very much. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. I want to make sure, am I broadcasting okay on the network? Can you? All right. I'm getting a nod from behind the glass, so I must be okay.
Maybe if you could just pull the microphone a little closer to you just so that you're sure everyone can hear you. Great.
Make sure. Okay. So my name is Mira Kohler, and I'm, as Senator Wilikowski said, I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Co-op. I've been with AVEC since 2000, been in the electric utility industry in Alaska since the year 1979.
You started with MLMP for a while, weren't you?
I was the general manager of MLMP from 97 to 2000. I was general manager of Nacmec Electric Association from 1990 to 1997, and I was manager of administration and finance at Cordova Electric Co-op in Cordova from 79 until 90. So electricity runs in my blood, not anything else, but... So I'm very familiar with rural Alaska. I'm also a member of the Commonwealth North Board of Directors and was tasked with co-chairing this task force that revealed this particular study earlier this year. I'm only going to give you a few slides from that study, but it highlights some of the issues that our coalition has identified, and it led from there to a vision of a true solution for Alaska. So with that, I'll move forward. We entitled our report, Energy for a Sustainable Alaska, the Rural Conundrum. Commonwealth North is, as you all know, a bipartisan entity that develops, identifies significant policy issues that impact Alaska and studies those and presents potential solutions to all those that are interested in those solutions. So our charge in this group was to develop an understanding of what is actually going on in rural Alaska in terms of energy production, transportation, and utilization, and what kind of solutions might exist to those challenges. So the participants in the group were way more than just Commonwealth North members. They were corporations from across the state. I think we had every single Native corporation present to us. We had NGO, public policy leaders. We had government agencies and the industry, of course. This is just a listing of the names of individuals that participated one time or another. We had a number of meetings that occurred between the middle of May of last year and the end of November, and the average meeting was attended by some 35 to 40 people, so it was very, very well attended, and these were all volunteers that were required to roll up their sleeves and go to work. So our first presenter actually was ICER. We had Heather Hudson, who is the executive director of ICER, and Steve Colt present to us. And they they illustrated from their report that was issued in 2008 on energy in rural Alaska what some of the challenges were. And one of the first one that pops up is how do Alaskans heat their buildings? And what you'll see is that in rural communities, about 80% heat their buildings with diesel fuel, the remaining being basically wood or other forms of biomass. And that is exactly the opposite in urban Alaska, particularly in Anchorage, where 84% of heat is provided by natural gas and 13% by electricity. This is a quick graphic of what has happened to fuel prices in recent years. You all know this story, so it's not a big surprise. But here's what AVEC has experienced. Just 10 years ago, in 2002, our delivered cost of a gallon of fuel was $1.29. And that is up to $4.27 as of last year, and it's tracking pretty close to that same number this year. So we've essentially seen more than a quadrupling of our cost of diesel fuel in the last 10 years. And that translates directly to the cost of a kilowatt hour of electricity. How much are we spending on home energy? This is simply electricity and heating fuel. It does not address the issue of transportation fuels. But you will see that in the lowest 20% of all households, income-wise, in 2000, rural Alaskans were spending about 16% of their disposable income on home energy. That number was tripled to 47% in 2008. And even though 2008 is a landmark year in our minds, because that was the year when oil hit $140 a barrel, the cost in 2008 actually reflected 2007 prices, not 2008 peak prices, because that impact was not felt until 2009. So it just shows you that a significant number of individuals in our population are spending a lot of their income on home energy. If you look at the middle 60% of households in the Anchorage area, 3.6% of gross income was being spent on home energy versus 12.7% in rural Alaska. So it's a significant difference. And on the other side of that coin, communities in remote Alaska use only a fraction of the amount of energy that is used in other parts of Alaska. So overall in Alaska, if you look at the bar on the far left, the average household or a consumer uses 55 barrels of oil equivalent for energy. In the PCE areas, which is remote rural areas, that number is about 26 barrels of oil. So we're using less than half the amount of energy but paying significantly more. No report on rural energy goes by without at least a brief nod to power cost equalization, which was established, as you all know, in 1984, and was intended to be a parity program to bring the cost of electricity down to a par with urban Alaska. Here's the reality, though. Electricity only accounts for 25% of the energy that a person consumes, and PCE really only pays for 20% of the cost of that 25%. So PCE basically accounts for 5% of the cost of energy in a rural household. The rest comes straight out of the consumer's pocket. This shows you how far a gallon of fuel has to travel to get to some of our communities, and accounts for the very high cost of fuel in those communities. The farther a gallon of fuel is transported, the more times it has to be touched to be transferred into smaller and smaller barges, and the more the cost goes. So the delivered cost of fuel, for example, to someplace like Kobuk is, well, we have to fly it in, but if you look at Ambler, it's about $5 a gallon delivered to Ambler by barge. If it has to be flown in, you can add another $2 to $2.50 a gallon to fly it in. We believe that one of the significant barriers that we need to overcome is to interconnect rural Alaska. We believe that strategically placed roads and transmission lines can play a very important role in decreasing the costs associated with energy development in rural Alaska. This study was done by the Denali Commission, or it was sponsored by the Denali Commission. They retained Nana Pacific to do a study of transmission lines in Alaska. And this was a hypothetical map showing how transmission routes could be established across the state to deliver energy to various parts of Alaska. The large red dots show where there is currently surplus energy available. The blue dots show you where fishing industries are thriving and need affordable energy. The yellow dots show you mining opportunities that are either currently being exploited or on the verge of being exploited. I think most of these are relatively current, other than the one that you see in the middle of the YK area, which I think is the Donlin Creek mine. And then, of course, in the southeast, you have timber efforts. This is the gauntlet of regulatory and permitting processes that you have to go through to develop any type of a project in not just rural Alaska, but urban Alaska. But the same gauntlet has to be traversed by rural projects as does urban projects. So as you can imagine, the very small projects wind up having a huge burden of regulatory processes to go through. And that is one of our conclusions, is that an entity needs to provide some sort of a clearinghouse in order to be able to do a one-stop shop for going through the regulatory process. So the findings of our group were sixfold. The first one is that Alaska needs a statewide energy vision, plan, and implementation strategy that incorporates a holistic view of statewide energy sustainability, serving all Alaskans similarly. The second finding is that the interconnection of rural communities into regional electrical transmission grids will develop economies of scale and create efficiencies. The third one is that the dependency on diesel fuel in rural Alaska must be reduced by whatever means that are practical, through increased efficiencies and through the utilization of viable alternatives. The fourth finding is that a single statewide entity could coordinate energy generation and transmission project selection and advocate for all regions of the state in a balanced fashion. The fifth one is that a one-stop shop to deal with permitting and federal regulators would be a very valuable element to enhance energy project development. And the final recommendation is that we need to eliminate the need for the PCE program by reducing the costs to rural consumers to levels that are acceptable and comparable to those on the rail belt. This is a slide that I pulled together that looks at what we are spending today on energy. And these numbers all come from credible sources. From the Alaska Power Statistics, we pulled out what the gross electric revenue, and this is retail revenue. This does not include industrial energy development. So, for example, the Red Dog's not included, North Slope Productions not included, the mines bases, all of those are not included in this number. So we're spending about $1 billion a year just on retail electricity. Whoops. Back up. There we go. The gas revenue is NSTAR's 2010 filing with the RCA. This is the gross gas revenue from retail sales. And then I computed what the diesel fuel is that's being used around the state, and this is a very modest number, and it's predicated to the amount of energy that's being used in electricity. And I just, instead of using four times that number, I used three times that number and came up with these gallons. So the 380 million gallons is probably about 75% of what is actually being consumed in rural Alaska. So if you peg the value of that of gallon of diesel at $4, that results in $1.5 billion a year being spent on just on diesel fuel for heat. So combining those three, we are spending $3 billion a year on energy, retail energy. That's $60 billion in 20 years. I would say that we have an adequate source of funds to deal with some real solutions. And so next we're going to go into real solutions. And with that, I am going to exit my presentation here. And Rob is going to step up to the plate and do his. And you were going to do it right off your thumb drive, right?
Mira, there's a question from Senator Dyson.
Yes, sir.
Two quick questions. By the way, you went far too fast for this old guy.
Fred, I'd be happy to do a private presentation to you anytime.
I hear from the oil industry that the state is doing a pretty good job of trying to streamline permitting on that side. Who knows how true that is. Is it your sense that the state is trying to help out the permitting process for electric power projects?
I think that the state and the federal government work reasonably well together. I know that the Denali Commission is wanting to drift sort of over into the avenue of being a facilitator for that process, and I think that's not a bad idea. For conventional electric generation and distribution, it's generally not that big a problem. But if you've got any type of federal funds involved in the project, so, for example, if we have Denali Commission or RUS funds involved, then you have to go through a NEPA process and a much wider federal process that can be quite daunting. The other thing that we have to deal with is, you know, AVEC is developing two very small hydro projects. One is on the island of Kodiak for Old Harbor. That's a 300 to 500 kilowatt project. And we're going through the FERC licensing process, and we have been working on that for a couple years now. We're a couple years away from where we can begin to actually build a project.
But is the state being pretty aggressive at trying to help in the permitting project process?
They are pretty proactive, yes. They have not been an enormous stumbling block. It's the Fed side that's more of a stumbling block.
Two other quick questions, Mayor. Somewhere in your discussion today, I hope someone can tell us what are the right-of-way issues and how much of those are on federal land, native land, and state land, and how much of a hassle you expect that would be. Last question, has anybody done an analysis on how much money could be saved in the marine delivery of fuel if we could get a Jones Act waiver?
You know, I'm not expert on that. AVEC has purchased or had built two sets of tugs and barges, and so we are actually in the business now of delivering fuel on the water. We contracted with a new company called Vitus Marine, and Vitus Marine actually is a very small group of basically three principals. They're the ones that actually arranged for the Renda to deliver fuel up to Nome. And so I would say that their principals would be pretty experienced in dealing with that issue as to whether – but Jones Act or no Jones Act, you're still dealing with a product that's expensive.
You didn't answer my question, but I think the answer is no.
No, that's, I started off with that.
Okay.
That, no.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mira. And we'll have Dr. Jacobson now. And if you could, before you start out, just tell us a little bit about who you are, what your background is. And that's because it is pretty impressive. And then give us your presentation.
Okay, fine. It sounds like it works all right. My name is Rob Jacobson. Basically, I started off life as a double E and then decided to get into physics and became an astrophysicist. My involvement with the HVDC started off in the late 80s, early 90s. When I joined ARCO Power Technologies, which is a subsidiary of ARCO Alaska, which they had put up in the Washington, D.C. area, specifically to look at the question, what do we do with all our gas? At that time, ARCO was operated by predominantly engineers, and they tend to be rather pragmatic. And they didn't believe there was any way you could make a gas pipeline and sell the gas at a profit. But they wanted to take their product to market. So the solution was, could we use high voltage DC and transfer it? And we did the studies, and it turned out that you could take power quantities of the orders of 8 gigawatts all the way down to the neighborhood of Tracy, California, and dump it into the U.S. grid at competitive prices. So it was a big yes. The actual study went nowhere for political reasons. The temperature in Alaska at that time was heading back towards another gas pipeline and LNG, and ARCO didn't want to get cross purposes with the government. So they just canned it, and it sort of went away, and we went on to do other things. One of the other things we did was the HARP program, building the Ionospheric Research Observatory up in Gakona, Alaska, which I was the program manager for, and spent nearly 20 years getting that structure through its various stages of design and construction. The talk that you hear today is basically compound input from many people. In addition to Marsh Creek, we have input from ABB, specifically through Krista Erickson, who is the Director of Business Development, and ABB have been very gentle and kind and produced a lot of technical information, which you see comes from them, as does a lot of the costing. They have installed or been responsible for the installation of 65% of the high-voltage DC lines in the world today, and they keep rather detailed databases, so the information we have on pricing on that is very realistic. What is not shown here is Mitsubishi Power. They didn't want their name on the view graphs, but they are happy to let us tell you that they have also provided information on their industrial gas turbines, which now operate at 60% thermodynamic efficiencies in a combined cycle operation. Also not in here, but we have been dealing with, and they do not want their name mentioned, as one of the big oil companies in town. They also have an interest in being able to purchase power and not generate it up there by themselves anymore, especially since their infrastructure is getting ancient, needs to be replaced. So they think it's a great idea as well, a big power plant up there. As you're all aware, we have a energy problem in the state at this time. The Cook Inlet gas fields are getting close to being used up. There's great hopes that drilling deeper and doing other things will increase the flow rate, but I think no matter how you do it, it's always going to be a stopgap measure and maybe advise you a few years before you go over the cliff. One solution is to import LNG. But the problem with LNG is your fuel costs at present in the Anchorage area will go from 5 cents per kilowatt hour to 17 cents per kilowatt hour. It's hardly a solution. The villages of rural Alaska are way off the rail belt grid or any extensions of it, and they need to be energized, which we do with diesel, which, again, is very expensive. Alaska's problem is energy is expensive, and it's on track to become even more so as the prices continue to ratchet up in the future. We have a even bigger problem. Alaska is an enormous state with a very small population, and it is also beset by very severe winters by lower 48 standards. And to survive in this environment, you need heat. And the cost of which in the rural income, in the rural communities, is 15% of those living there. And indeed, if you look at the lowest 20% of the population, the poorer ones, it's 50% of their income. And this is, as Mira pointed out, they even per capita consume less than anyone else. So these people are really struggling to, in fact, stay warm. Fairbanks prices are approaching $5 per gallon during winter, and again, that's a price which makes living in Fairbanks more and more difficult to do. You know, given the realities of the global market, with the explosive growth in China and India and in Brazil and that, despite the fact there's tremendous oil drilling going on everywhere, simple demand says that these prices are going to go up because you'll never be able to satisfy the energy needs out of the growing oil production, which you're seeing. And this just inflicts further hardship on the Alaskan communities, you know, who have to stay warm. And then, of course, the question comes up, a shortage of affordable energy. Well, you know, consider the energy on the North Slope. We know we have 35 trillion cubic foot, which has been discovered. And they estimate, based on the geology of the area, that there is another 125 trillion cubic foot, which will be technically recoverable, and it's just waiting to be identified. If you go down to the lower 48 and to all the shale beds, you find that the fracking has become prevalent, It's a fantastic technique, which really has resulted in the price of gas in the Henry Hub to drop to numbers of $2 to $3 per 1,000 cubic foot. And these techniques, if you look at the rest of the world, we're not unique. The shale beds, Marcellus shale beds, for one, underlying the gas production, exist everywhere on the planet. They're not unique to continental USA. And, you know, talks of liquefying our gas and shipping it to Asia, while make good press, why would Asia buy your gas when they can go frack their own at $2 a gallon? And they were. Yeah. So the question then comes that whether the oil companies or Alaska likes it or not, the North Slope gas is a stranded asset. And the question is, how does one use this plentiful source of very cheap energy for the benefit of all the Alaskan people? And technical solutions now exist. And the technical solution is high voltage direct current DC transmission, HVDC transmission. And there are two technologies in use, and I want to identify them now because later on in the talk it makes various parts more understandable. There is the conventional HVDC, which was where it all started off, which was how do you take massive amounts of power long ways. You have a big dam, you have lots of hydropower on it, and you want to get it to a city 1,000 miles away or 800 miles away. The solution was conventional HVDC. It has the advantage that the transmission line is very cheap, very, very much cheaper than an AC line for an equivalent power. The expensive part is the beginning and the ending, the converter stations, which take the AC generation, put it onto the line, and then take it off and put it into the grid. They're expensive. And as a result of this, it's not economic for lengths much under 300 miles. If you just look at economics, if you look at other aspects, which come up these days of environmental and right of way, and that it actually becomes economic well under 300 miles. Of late, started off in the late 90s, the question arose, well, we've solved the problem of getting power a long way, but these power lines go past various little cities and nothing comes down. And so how do you, in fact, pull a little bit of power off these big lines? And HVDC light came into being. HVDC light is nothing other than power electronics. It's based on, for one, the IGBT, which is the insulated gate bipolar transistors, and the gate optical gate transistors. And these things have allowed you to basically put a tap in an HV line and suck out tens of megawatts and transfer it tens of miles at an equivalent cost to an AC line. So tapping and getting power, especially what we're talking about, small blocks of power into various areas, has become a reality. And it started late 90s and the early 2000s that that technology is being developed, and it's really blossoming. And you'll see some examples later on. And what we are going to touch on now is concepts relevant to Alaska, and basically all of them are based on the combined cycle gas turbine generation, looking, as I said, with numbers from Mitsubishi for the combined cycle, 60% efficiency, just over 60% efficiency, gas energy into electrical energy at the output of the generator. And
can I just pause you for one moment and acknowledge that Senator Thomas from Fairbanks has been on the line in the LAO. And Senator Thomas, we'll give you a chance when we're done here if you have any questions.
Please. Thank you. And concept one is to energize the rail belt utility grids, and this is essentially replacing what Gretsch C was supposed to do, was intended to do, had it ever got out of committee. The original idea, which is sell power to the lower 48, and then concepts of energizing all Alaska using this gas source, the concept of electrical heating, and you'll see the costs are very much in favor, despite the differences in efficiency. The gas price being so much cheaper than oil, it actually is more cost-effective to heat using electricity. And then, of course, what's important to many Alaskans is heat and energize the smaller remote communities. And here's a sort of pretty picture of cartoon of what things would look like. You'd put a 1,000 megawatt, 1 gigawatt gas turbine plant would make a couple of generators to do this up on the North Slope. You build this 500 plus minus 500 kV bipolar line running from North Slope through Fairbanks to Anchorage. And you drop off power using the VSC technology in Fairbanks and Anchorage. And this then powers the rail belt, and traditional rail belt utilities, and gives you the sort of power that was identified in the RRPI studies of 760 growing to about 860 over the next 25 years of power. It's there, plus you can drive the all the oil industry on the North Slope. The other thing that can be done with a good stiff line connecting, running the backbone, is you can put wind. They are good wind resources. They're not excellent, but they're good wind resources up on the North Slope. Those wind resources are now mineable. You actually have a technique of getting the power into the marketplace. If you go to the Susitna Hydro Dam, you build that, you again have to take the power into the marketplace. This gives you the energy backbone which you can couple to. So these are adds to the basic concept. And certainly Susitna, if it gets up into the 600, 600 plus, you know, you can well conceive sending power up to the North Slope under certain conditions when loads are light elsewhere. We have some relatively good costs on this particular one. And if you look at the power plant, $1.25 billion. The line is 1.86, and these prices of the power plant include adders for working in the Arctic environment and getting up to the North Slope. These costs have all been taken into account over their standard build it in the Sahara type pricing. And then the converter stations gives you a total of $3.7 billion as the cost to construct and install. And then if you analyze the operating costs, assuming 30-year capitalization at 7%, and you could most probably do better than that, and 85% utilization of the plant in terms of average power, the gas running at the top end of what the Henry Hub is likely to be for the next months, if not years, at $3 per 1,000 cubic foot. And you put in there the O&M for the gas turbine power plant. Gas turbines are relatively expensive to maintain. And then the HVDC line system maintenance with the converter stations, plus all the regulatory insurance and other things, you end up with 9.3 cents per kilowatt hour. That is the cost of power delivered. There's no profits in here or anything. It's just the cost of power delivered to Fairbanks and Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman, question from Senator Dayton.
Go on, Senator.
How much fuel per day would an 833 megawatt plant use?
It's 0.104 billion cubic foot per day.
Say it again.
0.104 billion cubic foot per day. The gas pipeline was supposed to deliver something like 40.
Yeah.
So it's a very small percentage of what the gas pipeline would have delivered.
What would be the dynamics for the owners of the gas leases to be convinced they should sell gas at Henry Hub prices as opposed to a real or a projected market on the Pacific Rim?
I think you two issues involved here. One issue is the state owns a lot of the gas, and the second one is the Pacific Rim is going to frack. They're not going to buy gas, LNG gas from you at LNG prices if they can frack and suck it out the ground at $2 per 1,000 cubic feet. I mean, this is really the thing which is trapping the gas here, is the fact the market is disappearing. And they have adequate shale deposits in that part of Asia that they can go in there and pull the gas out at these same prices we can.
Thank you. Let me ask you a question on the marketability of excess power here in Alaska to either Canada or the lower 48 or somewhere else. What are your thoughts on that?
It definitely makes economic sense. The scale factors with the bigger plants drive the prices even lower. And you, on the next set of curves, you will actually see a hypothetical line going down to British Columbia and connecting into Canadian grid, which then feeds into the U.S. grid to deliver, 6 gigawatts. And we've got the pricing for that.
And do you think Alaska can be competitive with rates that would be charged out of the lower 48 or out of Canada?
Yes. Yes, we can be competitive with what they are paying at the moment. And this is the concept where you have a 6.4 gigawatt plant running at 800, plus or minus 800 kV bipolar, running down to Canada. The total distance there is about 2,100 miles. Which is a little bit further than what the Chinese have done, but not much. And this amount of power we're transferring is the same as what they're doing today in China. What's important about this is the plus or minus 800 kV line, the electrical losses on it are essentially the same as the losses in a gas pipeline. So if you want to, pump gas and make electricity at the end point, your overall loss in gas, the loss of efficiency, would be identical to generating at the source, bringing the power down. This is the break-even point voltage-wise. And again, here we go, look at the cost structure again, and we see that it's a $20 million investment. Doing the same arithmetic, you end up with about 7.4 cents per kilowatt hour as the cost delivered into the U.S. grid. The concept of energizing all Alaska, again, you put about 5 gigawatts up there, you run your big line, and then you have spurs running all over the place. This takes into account electrical heating as well as supporting fishing and mining. And then oil heating versus gas. You know, if you look at a gallon of number one, it's 130,500 BTUs. If you're purchasing it at $5 a gallon, then the equivalent electrical heating is 16.3 cents per kilowatt hour. That's assuming an 80% efficiency Tohono or one of those other little heaters. You know, Alaska consumes 380 million gallons of diesel each year, most of it for heating. Adjusting that downwards to accommodate for fuel, this is equivalent to 12.25 million megawatt hours of electrical generation, which could be provided by a 2.5 gigawatt stranded gas-fired power plant constructed on the North Slope. That's the electrical generation equivalent. Fairbanks alone consumes 250 million gallons of diesel each year. That same 2.5 gigawatt plant, together with HVDC transmission lines, could energize the entire rail belt and energize the Puto Bay oil field activities and provide electrical heating to Fairbanks at approximately 9 cents per kilowatt hour, which certainly undercuts the 16.3 and rising, which you're going to see.
Senator Dyson.
I'm trying to figure out a sentence structure here in the first sentence. Are you saying the electrical heat is 80% efficient?
No, I'm saying that if you take diesel and run it through these standard little Tula heaters, you basically have something of the order of 80% efficiency. That's heat in the room versus fuel. Fuel in 80% ends up as heat in the room. The rest goes out the exhaust and through exhaust stack.
So 100 years ago when I was in college, we used to say that electric heating was the most very inefficient. What are the conversion factors nowadays?
They say it's inefficient for the following reason, that you generate, especially in the old days, you generate with something like 30-35% efficiency coal to electricity, transfer it across to the residence where you'd lose a few more percent, and then use it to heat the baseboards. The actual heating process is extremely efficient, but you've lost the energy in generation and transfer, which you would have recovered had you taken the same coal and burnt it in the house and what goes up the fireplace. You'd mostly end up with 80% of the heat retained inside the structure. What we are doing today is with the 60% generation efficiency and a 4.5% transmission loss from the North Slope down to something like Fairbanks, you actually are getting 55% of the available energy ends up in the house versus the 80% which ends up in the house from burning the oil. But since the gas is so much cheaper than the oil, you are way ahead in the cost of providing heating.
Okay, now I get why you and I are seeing it different. We're
right.
Talking about the cost of delivering fuel, liquid fuel now,
right,
as opposed to it. Because all of us think we know that if you've got gas available, don't have electric dryer or electric stove or electric heat, but you're figuring in the fuel cost difference in remote areas. Thank you.
That's exactly right. I mean, you don't have gas, but you can run a power line a lot cheaper than you can run a gas line.
Yeah, I got it. Thank
yeah.
you.
And on the next one, heating of remote communities, here you get into the issues Mira made this morning. Up there it's $7 a gallon. That's the equivalent of 23 cents per kilowatt hour. That's pretty ferocious heat, given the fact most of it goes in heat. And HVDC light is on the cusp of becoming economic for providing heat and power to these remote communities. And we just have to bear in mind that plentiful, affordable energy is a stepping stone from survival to a viable village economy. That plentiful, affordable energy is the key to unlock Alaska's remote resources, and that affordable energy is the engine of a viable statewide manufacturing and industrial base. If you can't make it at less price than that can be done somewhere else, you aren't going to make it. And so, you know, what we're advocating is a stranded gas-powered Alaska energy infrastructure, and it's to benefit all the Alaskans. The gas provides electrical power provides heat, cheap power fuels economic growth, and we ship made in Alaska, not pieces of Alaska, in barrels or in cargo ships or carriers. And most important thing is it provides lots of good jobs. And just touch on what the state of the art internationally on where HVDC is used. The top little picture here is a picture of Itapu. It's on the border. It's a huge dam, generates 12.6 gigawatts on the border of Paraguay and Brazil. Half the power goes to Paraguay and through three 800 kV AC lines. The other half goes onto 600 kV DC lines into Brazil. One of it goes down to San Paulo, and I forget exactly where the other one goes. The second picture gives a comparison. There's 3 gigawatts in the 500 kV line running on the right, and there's 400 megawatts running in a 345 kV line on the left. The economies of scale become very apparent. China, when they looked at the three gorges, HVDC versus AC, the top two are HVDC, 500 kV, 6 gigawatt, And if you had to do that with AC, you had five towers, each carrying three conductors to carry the same amount of power. So you see immediately the reduced right-of-ways, the simpler structure, and when you run thousands of miles, it ends up being a lot of money, which doesn't get spent by transferring it as DC. So you get more power and fewer lines. It's more stable. There are no reactive losses. There's no vast quantity of energy bouncing around, which you need to make the system work, which AC has. So you get a better stability on the line, reduced losses because the entire portion of the conductor is being used, not just the skin current effect, and cheaper to install. And here we have some examples of lines in service. The first one, Cahora Bassa, connects the fourth largest lake, man-made lake in Mozambique on the Zambezi River to Johannesburg, South Africa. Built in 1979 using mercury arc rectifiers, it's been upgraded now to silicone. It's been in operation ever since. 2 gigawatts flowing 900 miles at just over 500 volts. The other end, you have the Xingzhaba Shanghai, which is a Xingzhaba, is a dam built on a tributary to the Yangtze running to Shanghai. Power 6.4 gigawatts. It's running 1,300 miles. It went in service in 2010 and is running at full rated capacity, and it's plus or minus 800 kV. There's the Pacific Intertie, which is built in the States, connecting Washington State to California. It's connecting the Bonneville Dams to L.A. And simply put, the need for it is that in winter, Washington heats electrically, and L.A. has wonderful winters. So they pump the power, 3 gigawatts, up from L.A. to Washington to supplement the water dam-driven electricity to heat. In summer, L.A. needs lots of air conditioning, and you open the doors in Washington and enjoy the fresh breeze. So they then pump all the heating electricity down to L.A. to drive the air conditioners. And that's been in service since 85. It also started off life with mercury arc rectifiers and has now been upgraded to silicone. And there's a few others around which have similar stories. With the advent of the light, HVDC light, this here was moving power from the tip of Norway into an oil platform arranged, Valhall, out in the ocean. And this went into service in 2009. They transport about 80 megawatts, the number you would think about in terms of heating and power. It's 300 kV AC in, 11 kV AC out on the oil drilling platform, 150 kV line, and the length of cable is 182 miles offshore. And the main reason for choosing the HVDC in this thing is the environment. You can't run AC in a cable for 50 miles. Most of the power's gone. AC cable is strictly short-term, a couple of miles or forget it. Here you can go hundreds of miles, no problem at all. Less maintenance on a lighter platform. The solution was, if you couldn't get the HVDC cable out there, you had to put diesels and then fuel them. So environmentally, it's kinder, it's smaller and lighter. So that was what drove that solution. There's also the East Link, which is joining Soviet Estonia grid to the modern Finnish grid. This contract was signed in 05. It went in service in November 06, 19 months from signing contract, handing over the keys. And it's 350 megawatts being transferred in two cables across the Baltic Sea into Estonia. And the rationale for that, to going with the HVDC light, is they wanted an asynchronous tie. They wanted black start capability because the Estonian grid simply wasn't strong enough to support a commutated conventional HVDC line, and that was their solution. And the interesting part here is 19 months at 350 megawatts. In summary, HVDC transmission provides a means of moving bulk power long distances more cost-effectively and at greater efficiency and stability than conventional AC transmission. HVDC light can provide taps to Alaska's diversified and sparsely scattered communities. HVDC and modern industrial gas turbine technology provides a cost-effective means of powering the rail belt with the stranded gas, taking stranded gas to market through as electrical power, integrating Alaska's diversified and sparsely scattered population centers into a viable economic engine, and heating Alaska. And I'd like to just leave as the take-home message, Alaska does not have a shortage of cheap energy. On the contrary, it has a vast supply. The problem is gaining access to it. HV transmission technology in conjunction with modern combined cycle industrial gas turbine can unlock this energy source at its source and deliver power to the Alaskan population at large at very competitive costs, cents per kilowatt hour, less than you're paying now. It's time to exercise the political will to invest in this infrastructure project and free the Alaskan people from the tyranny of the ever-increasing cost of staying warm. And just remember, just surviving is not living.
Thank you. Dr. Jacobson, thank you for your testimony. We have a question from Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Where are we at in our agenda?
This is it. We're at question and answer right now.
Right. So I was very enthused when we visited here a few months ago about this. And I approached the administration about it. And my sense was, and I'm not speaking for them, that they were not interested in a project that required public money to be invested. And that's just my reading of that conversation. And kind of the implication was, if it's such a wonderful idea, why doesn't the private sector come build it, operate it, and make good money off of it, and everybody's happy? Has the private sector in any of these big projects you've been involved in done it without public investment?
I think certainly in the lower 48, many of the utilities have put these systems in place with using money that they have raised. Yeah, and I think there's an economic case can be made for an investment group funding this as well.
Right, so it seems to me the state would need to be very helpful with the right-of-way issues and the sale of the state's royalty share of the gas,
exactly,
or pressuring the gas cap owners to put their gas on the market and
right.
So on.
I think that, sorry to interrupt, but I think, you know, to just elaborate on your point, the state has an interest in negotiating long-term gas contract pricing. Otherwise, things like this come off the rails and they get expensive. So there's very, very long-term pricing has to be established, and I think the state is part of the organization which establishes those prices for the citizens.
Yeah, and the other piece, of course, is the state has a responsibility to making sure that gas sold now doesn't shape, work negatively against oil recovery and,
right,
and all those things,
right,
of reservoir management. I suspect our chairman here is pretty enthusiastic as well. What would be the next step for us to make it possible for a private investor to come and solve all of our problems in the way that you have elucidated today?
I think the next step is certainly a more detailed design study, which certainly addresses not only the line running from the North Slope down to Anchorage, but the spurs running out to the various villages and remote communities, establishing the most appropriate and cost-effective technologies and at which point you break down into AC distribution grids. I think a lot of that work hasn't been done yet, and it's just been estimated as rule of thumb. And I think that's the first next step, is a decent study which comes up with realistic, not that these prices are not realistic, but harder pricing data. And this document is then the basis of what you go out into the marketplace with and say, this is how you guys can make some money.
So then who should do that study?
I believe it is something that we are interested in doing if we can get adequate funding to support the study.
And adequate funding means the state's money, public money?
Yes, not necessarily.
One thing that we have been doing also is making this presentation to a number of different entities. I believe that some of the larger regional corporations would have an interest in it. I have talked with ASRC, and we'll probably be having a meeting with a larger ASRC committee as well as with NANA. It's been suggested that we present to the 13 ANCSA CEOs, which we will do. The issue becomes, how do we keep this a public project that's owned by the citizens of Alaska? And, you know, obviously I'm in a nonprofit utility, and all of us, most Alaskans are served by nonprofit electric utilities. And so we have an interest in seeing that this remains in the concept of what we call a G&T, a Generation and Transmission Co-op, which is the model that's used in the lower 48. The challenge that we have is that all of us rolled together do not have the credit capacity to take on a project of this size, because a sizable element of it is displacing a current form of energy, which is heat. And so were we already modeled in that fashion, we would have better financing capability, but we're not. And so the issue becomes, how do we structure this in a tiered fashion so that you deal with it in a three-step process, and the funding builds upon the initial project. So we're meeting with a lot of entities that are interested. In fact, this afternoon, ASEP and some of their key people are coming down. We're going to be talking about, you know, brainstorming how do we move forward with this, and what players do we need at the table. You know, it's a $20 billion project if we go with a 6.5 gigawatt project. And that includes exportation potentially of some energy. In the state, in 2010, according to Alaska Power Statistics, we actually sold about 6.5 billion kilowatt hours in the state. So we're talking about quadrupling that number. So it's an exciting concept, and I think that the utilities will be very excited about it. We're not trying to displace anybody. We're not trying to put NSTAR out of business, for example, but they may get put out of business just because of the way that the world works in terms of gas supply. We want to have a backup plan for when that happens. In the meantime, Fairbanks is strangling and needs help sooner than later, and this could be built to Fairbanks quite readily. So I think that they're very interested up there, and you know, we're going to continue discussing with them, and we would like to fast-track this because we believe that this is something that can be done within a decade.
If I may, if I understand what you just said, it is, you think it's more appropriate and more practical for it to be a publicly owned infrastructure?
Well, when I say public, I'm thinking public utility.
Okay. All right. And I assume you've been in contact with the railroad utilities?
We actually just made a presentation this morning to the ArcTech group, and we've been up to Fairbanks and presented to Golden Valley. We'd like to present to others as well, but this is still early in the game. We debuted this July 13th, so it's only been a month. And as folks get more knowledgeable about it, I think there'll be more enthusiasm built up, and we'll be able to start making progress.
I would guess that many, if not most, legislators would be interested in kept up to date on where you're going. And certainly when you're dealing with me, as you've done for 20 years, make it real simple, like, what do you want me to do? To you know, least to quit or to not impede the process, and hopefully be helpful.
And we're thinking in terms of coming forth to this legislature with a fairly modest funding proposal, modest maybe in the legislature's eyes. I mean, I think it's big money, but we're probably going to need a couple million dollars. But, you know, we threw $10 million at the Chicoutimi project and $65 million at the Susitna project, so $2 or $3 million to further the studies on this shouldn't be an unreachable goal. And that at least will bring it to pass to the pre-CDR stage, which is what we call the concept design, to where you actually have a peer-tested report on what this could potentially mean and how we can proceed forward.
Thank you.
Do we have any questions?
Thank you for allowing me to.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for the questions. I know we had Senator Thomas online. Senator Thomas, did you have any questions, or any other legislators online have any questions?
This is Senator Thomas from Fairbanks, and yes, I did. I appreciate the presentation, Mira and Dr. Jacobson, and the thought of at least looking at this, I think, is extremely important, because every time, you know, we've been through a lot of gas line proposals, a lot of other projects around the state. We have private companies that are looking at building gas lines and power lines themselves, depending on, you know, where their resource extraction companies, basically. But this, for some reason, has never really surfaced much as far as bringing the power from Prudhoe Bay. And the other day I asked somebody why that was, and I really didn't get didn't get a very good explanation of why not. And when I hear you talking about it, I realize you just looked at it, you know, a fairly cursory look of what it would cost to come from at least Prudhoe Bay to build that backbone from Prudhoe Bay to the Cook Inlet area for that kind of money, and the amount of gas that's being used versus being, you know, roughly, and I realize I'm not going to hold you to any numbers here, roughly half the cost of building a gas line that would bring much more gas than you're using up there, obviously. So you crank up the amount of production there with a larger plant, add some more money. So did you look at all at that $4 billion versus, you know, the alternatives that are $8 billion or $20 billion or $30 billion, depending on what you're doing with gas? And I also appreciate you looking at it as a, not necessarily a public utility, but a cooperative or something, because I think that's important to make sure that we do keep the costs of what's going on very transparent to the consumer. So I guess my question in the long run, and you mentioned just a few of the projects that we spent money on. We spent a lot of money on projects that did not work very well. So I think to at least get a better concept of how this one works, it definitely should be funded by the state to evaluate the realistic, whether it's realistic or not to do this. I'm not saying your approach wasn't or not. I'm just saying that I think it's incumbent on the state actually to do that if we're actually looking at solutions, which we've found some that will not work anyhow, particularly for the rural areas. And I don't know if there's a question in there anywhere, but
I think there was a little bit of a question, because you had something there early on about the comparable of building a gas pipeline and bringing the gas down to where the users are versus building the North Slope generation and delivering the power by wire. I'm not sure that the concept of building North Slope generation has ever been really seriously studied, other than by the oil companies in the 80s, and then they were looking at it primarily to serve themselves. There hasn't been an understanding, I think, that HVDC is actually not only a very viable technology, it's a very, very well-tested technology that is being used across the world to transmit large amounts of power. And we've always just looked at wires in the context of electricity. We haven't considered electric heat as being a viable energy source in this state, and that's where we've missed the boat, is by not looking at it that way. When we look at the economics of building a gas pipeline, the consumption of gas in, you know, for retail utilization is really quite modest, and the cost of building extensions of that gas line across the state are very large. So we've never really had an all-Alaska solution, and until we look at heat and electricity by wire, it's not approachable. We've looked at propane. We've looked at other things that are really not viable for full-scale conversion to any other form of heat. So this is the first time it's really been taken a hard look at.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for attending. I know as I look out in the crowd, we have a who's who of Alaska energy mines here in Alaska. So it's good to see everyone here. And I remember when we've discussed over the years ways to get our natural gas to market. I know this issue has come up, and I think it was dismissed, but this is going back five, six years ago, and I guess the technology's improved. And one of these days, we are going to have to figure out a way to provide low-cost energy and heating to rural Alaska and to Fairbanks. We've got to do it because those communities are suffering, and they're not going to be there for much longer if we continue to go the way we're going. So I applaud you for bringing this forward. I think it is something that's worth looking at, and I think it's worthy of a state investment to figure out whether or not this is where we want to proceed. I know there's been other solutions, shipping propane out to rural Alaska, getting LNG out to rural Alaska. There's a lot of different ideas. I think we need to take a comprehensive approach and look at all those ideas and figure out which one is going to work best for Alaska and for rural communities and the interior. With that, we'll adjourn. It's about 1:07, and I want to thank everyone again for coming.
Thank you.
Very good.